I guess we could start, huh?
Alana's here today, so I feel much
more. Well, I know. I feel so much more, so much safer with Alana here. We were just on the edge for almost a month. I thought she'll get back and have to bail me out of jail instead of keep me out. It's so much easier to keep us out of jail than to get us out of jail, Alana. So we're glad you're here now. It was fine when Lynette was here, too, but when we were lawyerless there, I don't know. It was like a couple of days of... All right, enough of that. Good morning, everybody. It is 10 a.m., August 4th, 2010. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission meeting for its almost regularly scheduled biweekly meeting in the commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the Capitol. It's Kevin Kramer along with Tony Clark and Brian Kulk. The reason I say almost is it may have been obvious to people that this is a bit irregular and that we are meeting 1 week after our most previous meeting. And while we don't normally do that, given the challenges of August scheduling and specifically vacations as much as anything, we will be taking a three-week break between meetings now in August. So given the heavy load on our in our docket, we thought it'd be wise to have a meeting 1 week after last Wednesday, and it's turned out to be a pretty good call, I would say, because while it's not a real long agenda, it is a rather meaty agenda today. So with that, welcome to everybody. We do have a number of guests in the room, and it's great to see you all here. With that, I would turn it over to my colleagues for any opening comments of welcome.
Good morning and welcome.
Good morning and welcome, and kind of amplify Kevin's comments. Just want a big thanks to the PSC staff, because we sat here last week and we talked about what might be on this week's agenda, and it turned out there's some major items that were put together this week. And so the staff, I know, really worked a lot. I mean, they always work hard, but this week especially, getting all this stuff put together to keep the good things going on in the state. So thanks to everybody for that.
All right. And with that, I would move passage of items in the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Now to the regular agenda. Item KC1, I move the commission deem the applications complete and issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in the request of Bridger Pipeline LLC for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, a corridor certificate, and a route permit for the construction of approximately 77 miles of crude oil pipeline in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings counties of North Dakota, case number PU09750.
Second.
This is a case that we've been watching for a little while because we did receive the letter of intent, I think it was December of last year. The interesting thing about, I noticed in reading the permit application and the letter of intent, is that the line has changed a fair bit in that short time frame, and it's pretty indicative of what we're seeing, I think, in the oil field in general. When we received the letter of intent, it was a 10-inch, 85-mile pipeline. We received the permit application is now a 12-inch pipeline, so it's a pipe, much larger pipe, 12-inch, 20% larger, and it's now a 77-mile pipeline because it's more a more direct route. So what we have done, though, is, of course, deemed the application complete. We are scheduling the hearing, or have scheduled the hearing, for September 9th, 2010 at 12 noon Mountain Daylight Time at the City Hall, 165 Railroad Street Southeast in Killdeer, North Dakota. I don't believe we've had a hearing in Killdeer, at least not since I've been on the commission, have we had a sighting hearing in Killdeer, but that is about in the middle of the three counties. It's the closest to the line itself. As I said in the motion, this line does span three counties. After the letter of intent was received, they did go into an open season to find producers and takers for the capacity, and that's what caused the pipe to be expanded from a 10-inch to 12-inch pipe, 60,000 barrels of oil per day capacity, which, of course, the good news about this line is while it does not increase the actual export capacity, what it does do is it provides three possible export markets for the Bakken and Three Forks crude in these three counties, because this line will have offtakes at the Tesoro line, the Belfuche line that goes to Tesoro, the line that goes to Guernsey, Wyoming, and then, of course, it also has an offtake onto the Enbridge system, which takes oil then to Clearbrook, Minnesota. So providing three possible markets obviously gives shifts that sort of that price advantage from the the demand side to the supply side, so it has that advantage. The other, I think, probably most important advantage in today's environment in the oil field is that, of course, this will take a lot of trucks off of the roads and the highways in western North Dakota. So we're glad to see the project before us, but of course it is our job to make sure that it is sited in a manner that ensures a minimal adverse impact on our cultural natural resources and our people. With that, everything does seem to be in order. I've read this application rather thoroughly already because it's one that's been interesting to me for some time, so look forward to it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Item KC2. I move the Commission approve revision number 19 to surface coal mining permit NAFK 9503 held by Falkirk Mining Company to allow the mining of additional lands within the permit area, to add design plans for two sedimentation ponds, and to update other sections of the permit to reflect the additional mining.
Second.
I'm going to veer for just a second and look at staff. There is a fair bit of construction going on, if you hadn't noticed, in our office. There are two offices being renovated. Do you think we should shut the door just in case? That little tapping of the hammer reminded me that yesterday it got really loud a couple of times up here. I think all of the heavy machinery is not operating right now, but the saws and drills, right?
Yes.
The sanders. All right. This is a pretty, let's see here. Yeah, this is a pretty standard revision. This is actually one that's been in front of us for a while because we did have, early on, we did have a constituent or citizen ask some questions and challenge a couple of issues that have been settled since in informal hearing with an administrative law judge. But the primary purpose of the revision is to modify Falkirk's mine plan to mine additional lands within the current permit area. And as a result of the changes, mining will be a little closer to GRE, or Great River Energy's transmission line that connects to Coal Creek Station and to the Stanton Station than previously proposed. And so that, along with all of the usual, the new all the new landowner issues or mineral ownership issues and whatnot that have to be addressed in a revision are all appropriate, and the staff has done a good job of recommending that we pass the revisions.
All in favor?
Aye.
KC3 and 4, of course, go together. KC3, I move the Commission approve revision number 9 to surface coal mining permit number BNCR 9401 held by BNI Coal Limited for the Center Mine to identify the next 5-year coal removal subarea and to update other plans and information in the permit for the next 5-year permit term.
Second.
So this is just the standard 5-year revision that then is followed by the 5-year renewal of the permit area, and there's always lands to be mined, a few revisions here and there. The coal removal from the area won't be completed for a long time, so in all likelihood in 5 years we'll be doing this same drill again, but everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
And then KC4, I move the Commission approve renewal number 3 for surface coal mining permit number BNCR 9401 held by BNI Coal Limited for the Center Mine to extend the permit term for another 5 years until August 16th, 2015.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Then KC5. I move the Commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order in Enbridge Pipelines North Dakota LLC's application to expand and upgrade its existing Berthold Station in Ward County, North Dakota, case number PU-10130. This is an interesting project that became more interesting earlier this week. As you know, Enbridge Pipeline has made some major expansions on its North Dakota system in the last 4 or 5 years, more than doubling their export capacity on the North Dakota line that runs to Clearbrook, Minnesota. They have since come to us, just earlier this year, with another 2-year expansion plan that includes about $500 million worth of investment, expansion of export capacity out of the Bakken to the tune of 140,000 more barrels per day. This particular project at Berthold is the first phase of several phases over the next 2 years to increase that capacity to reverse the what's known as the portal line, so that Bakken crude would then be transported up to Canada, to Cromer, Manitoba, and then get on their system back down to Clearbrook, Minnesota. We held a hearing on this expansion. This is, like I said, it's not a real big expansion. It's an expansion of their existing pump station, which is right at Berthold, just off of the off of Highway 2, just east of a rail spur that crosses all four lanes of Highway 2, which is part of what makes this a little more interesting than most projects of its type. It does involve the acquisition of 80 additional acres, 8 truck offloads into this system. We had a very good hearing in Berthold. There was a lot of public interest from a lot of public officials, some concerns about safety issues, to the point where the whole hearing pretty well focused, once we got through the basic things, on traffic safety, given the unique aspects of a four-lane, 70-mile-per-hour fast traffic crossing a rail line. It's interesting to note that this is the only rail line that crosses Highway 2 at grade level. It is a spur. It is within hundreds of yards of the approach into this pumping station. It is also on the east side of the railroad, which means, of course, that trucks full of oil will cross the tracks before turning south into the station. It means that empty trucks will cross the eastbound lane, turn into the westbound lane, and then be forced to stop very shortly after that, as they are hazardous materials trucks. We'll have to stop at the railroad and before moving on. So a lot of the testimony and evidence focused on those safety factors. It was important enough that even the director of the Department of Transportation, Francis Ziegler, was at the hearing and did testify and did agree with the company to work closely with Enbridge and the local community to make sure that any modifications would meet the safety requirements of the Department of Transportation. We have since received a very specific plan with how to deal with those safety issues. It has been signed off on by the Department of Transportation as well as Enbridge. It involves the adding of a right turn lane for the trucks to move into, to turn into the Enbridge facility. It also involves a left turn lane, an additional third lane on the westbound side, so that as trucks exit the Enbridge facility, they have their own lane to turn into. They will stop. Then when they go back west, they will stop at the railroad tracks. And so the faster traffic won't have to be impeded by them. At the same time, they've also agreed to lowering the speed limit at the area, which is probably as important a safety factor as anything. And so all of the experts have signed off on that. And we appreciate the hard work that everybody put into that. Now, we did become aware, although it is, at least to my knowledge, there's not been an official filing with us, but we were aware at the time of the hearing, and we've become aware that the local zoning board had some questions and some concerns and had not yet zoned that 80 acres for commercial or industrial use. It is currently zoned agricultural. It came to our attention that earlier this week the zoning board has decided to recommend to the Berthold City Commission that it not be zoned commercial or industrial. And so that changes in our world a fair bit. And so we've added a couple of clauses in the ordering clauses. And there are several ordering clauses on this particular order, by the way, more than most. I think 26 or something like that. But I thought it would be useful just to go over the law a bit with regard to our jurisdiction in the context of community's jurisdiction and how those two are reconciled when there's a difference. Our siting law simply states in Chapter 4922, a permit for the construction of a transmission facility, and it is important to note this is a transmission facility. While it sounds more like an energy conversion facility, it really is the part of a transmission line, so it is a transmission facility. That a permit for the construction of a transmission facility within a designated corridor may supersede and preempt any local land use, zoning, or building rules, regulations, or ordinances upon a finding by the commission. That's very important. Upon a finding by the commission that such rules, regulations, or ordinances as applied to the proposed route are unreasonably restrictive in view of existing technology, factors of cost or economics, or needs of consumers regardless of their location. Without such a finding by the commission, no route shall be designated which violates local land use, zoning, or building rules, regulations, or ordinances. So we are going to issue the order today. We're going to vote on the motion, and if it passes, we will issue the order. But here are the two ordering clauses that are necessary to accommodate and to appreciate what's going on in Berthold with the local community. First is, I'd go to order number two, order clause number two, that the certificate of corridor compatibility issued to Enbridge designating the corridor for its proposed pipeline project is conditioned on compliance with local land use, zoning, and building rules, regulations, and ordinances. The same language is in ordering clause number three, which applies to the route permit specifically. Again, that this grants authority to construct and operate the upgrades to the Berthold station conditioned on compliance with local land use, zoning, and building rules, regulations, and ordinances. So how all that turns out, we don't know, but you know, we feel like with the evidence that's in the record and the testimony from the hearing, that this is the appropriate order. And if for some reason the local officials disagree, then it'll be incumbent upon the company to decide what their next move might be.
I would just, I guess, I don't know if Tony had anything to add, but the Kevin did a wonderful job of laying it out. The big thing that comes out of these, sometimes we'll vote on something, and the perception in the community is the commission has approved it and the project can be built. You break it down into to layman's term, it's up to the community to develop their community the way they want to develop it, and they've cleared, the company's done the things that we've required them to in our jurisdiction. And this is not uncommon. A lot of the wind farms we do, it'll say in the findings that contingent upon a finding of no significant impact, then the order is deemed appropriate. So it's not like this is the first time we've done this, but it's always one thing that it's important to make it clear to the folks out there that this is just one step and that we're not out there trying to strong-arm any communities. We're setting the stage. It's up to them to do what they want to do. And that's really, I guess, really what the point of the whole discussion was here. So, but I do support it with those additional language items in there.
And it doesn't restrict the commission's ability to look at anything in the future. And I don't make that statement with any, I mean, that's a completely objective statement. I don't mean anything to be read into that at all. All it means is the order is what it is. On the, you know, with the information that we had at the time, we believe that all the state standards have been met. Now there can be things that go on at the local level, and those things that happen at the local level could mean that they become state issues again and we might have to look at them again, but we do it basically as a blank slate at that time. And nothing that we've determined here would prejudice ourselves or would make any decision on what's going on at the local level. That is really something they need to decide on their own. It may or may not ever come back to the commission.
Yeah. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. And then KC6. I move the commission authorize staff to write change orders to contract number AM59110 with BNC Concrete Pumping, Inc. to increase the amount of the original contract by $100,000 for additional grout that may be needed at the Williams County Road 9 Phase 5 AML project.
Second.
You will recall probably that in May we awarded this contract to BNC in the amount of just about $214,000 for drilling and pressurized grouting at the Williams County Road 9 project. During the drilling phase of the project, however, there were many more mine voids that were located than expected, and some voids are much larger than anticipated, and so more grout is needed to fill them. The quantity of the grout estimated for the project was actually 1,000 cubic yards, but it appears like it may require more like 2,000 cubic yards, so it's nearly, well, it's twice as much, obviously. BNC Concrete Pumping is willing to pump additional grout at a rate of $99 per cubic yard, which was what their bid was for the original project in the first place. And so our change order policies as a commission allows the staff to change orders, write change orders up to 20% of the original contract amount without formal action by the commission. But since they're about ready to get to that limit, the staff is requesting our approval for writing a change order for an additional $100,000. And this would allow the contract to be increased up to $313,875 if needed. And we have plenty of funds, federal funds, that free money that falls out of the sky from Washington, D.C., and AML grants to cover the increase. Actually, it's not, doesn't fall out of the sky. It's paid by our coal companies right here in North Dakota. Just has to go to Washington before we get it back. Don't get me started.
All in favor?
Aye.
That ends the items of my portfolio finally, Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. Item TC1, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, issuing certificate of site compatibility for energy conversion facility number 17 to Ashtabula Wind 3, LLC, authorizing construction of its proposed 69-megawatt wind energy conversion facility in Barnes County, North Dakota. This was about as straightforward a wind farm application and siting hearing as we've had in quite some time. We held it in Valley City. This is a project that is proposed to be adjacent to the existing Ashtabula 1 Wind Energy Center. It's one that we received no dissenting comments from the community or landowners or anyone like that. It was not nearly well as attended as the pipeline hearing that that Kevin just spoke about. But nonetheless, the issues that we look at are we give it as much due diligence as we possibly can. This project, as I noted, is located in Barnes County. It's approximately 8 miles north of Valley City, and it's adjacent to the existing Ashtabula Wind 1 Energy Center. The project itself consists of about 19 square miles of area. Of course, the land that's disturbed by the actual turbines themselves is much, much smaller than that. It's only about 206 acres, or about 1.7% of the total project site. The nameplate generating capacity of this wind farm is 69 megawatts, and it consists of up to 43 1.6-megawatt turbines and the associated facilities that that go along with those. As far as the cost of this project, it's estimated to be about $140 million investment, and they have indicated that they expect construction to take approximately 5 months, which is rather remarkable when you think about the amount of money and investment that's going into that that particular project, and that they expect to have it done in just 5 months. As I said, there was not a lot of controversy with this particular one. With every wind farm, the developers get a little bit more keenly aware of the issues that we're probably going to look into, and so the applications become more complete and issues are taken care of ahead of time. One that is perhaps a little bit different than some of the other ones we've dealt with, but has been appropriately mitigated, was in the sound studies that were done. It was shown that with one particular residence, the modeling indicated that there might be a slight exceedance of the noise guidelines that we've typically followed. Now, as we've said before, the 1,400-foot setback requirement that the commission has used as a rule of thumb is not a hard and fast rule, but it's really driven by the dynamics of each individual wind site. So it's based on flicker. It's based on noise studies that we have the company conduct, and it just so happens that 1,400 feet is about what the right distance is. Now, in this case, what you have is a couple of different farms that are adjacent to each other. So the existing farm and the new proposed farm have to be taken together when the modeling is done. And there's one residence where that sound level was exceeded, even though the residence itself is beyond 1,400 feet. In this case, what we have done is required the applicant, NextEra, to submit some additional information into the record, and the affected landowner has now entered into a waiver agreement regarding potential noise exceedance at Ashtabula 3, and that was comforting to me, number one. Number two, the exceedance was very slight, and it was only on a few occasions that that the modeling indicated it might go above our general rule of thumb. So with that, everything else appears to be in order, and I recommend approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
TC2, I move the commission cancel the August 31st, 2010 hearing and issue an order in case number GE-10-325 granting the request of North Dakota Oilseed Mills, LLC, to operate a 50,000-bushel grain warehouse at Northwood, North Dakota, conditioned upon satisfactory showing of statutory compliance and submission of a $100,000 bond and written confirmation of North Dakota Oilseed Mills LLC's agreement, assuring the commission that all scale tickets issued for grain received will be immediately converted into cash.
Second.
As you know, this is a case that has received some attention, primarily because of the past with this particular facility. This was a facility, and at least a good portion of the ownership group of this facility is similar to the pre-existing one, where there was an insolvency. It was an insolvency that appears to be primarily related to the extreme volatility that existed in the seed oil market at the time that insolvency happened. So now that this facility with a slightly different ownership group has come back for relicensing, the commission has felt it needed to have a little bit more due diligence and a little bit closer scrutiny of this licensure application as compared to kind of a generic run-of-the-mill one that we get. Early on, the commission had scheduled a hearing for August 31st in case we needed it, and that was a placeholder. By this order, we'll be canceling that. Basically, what this does is it permits North Dakota Oilseed Mills LLC to get back into business with a 50,000 bushel grain warehouse. And this $100,000 bond is actually double what, if we just followed the commission's traditional bonding schedule, what it would be. It would typically be a $50,000 bond. We're requiring $100,000 in this case, given the extenuating circumstances. The other thing that's substantially different here is we are conditioning it upon North Dakota Oilseed getting a letter to us confirming that they will operate this on a cash-only basis. This was the decision that the commission is arriving at was done after significant consultation with our professional staff about this matter. As I said, this is one that we looked over a lot more closely than we do most licensure applications. And we had our director of economic regulation, who's a CPA, look it over, in addition to our grain elevator warehousing staff. And what we came to the conclusion was that by operating on a cash-only basis, and then in addition, I will tell you up front, we're going to have staff oversight of this facility more aggressively and probably on a more frequent basis than you would with an elevator that hasn't had this particular past. But operating on a cash-only basis so that the timing of cash sales and expenditures is much more closely timed, along with a higher bond, gives me the assurance that this facility can get up and going. Also, this is one of these issues where the commission has to strike the right balance, and it's about creating a balance that's right, not only for the applicant, but more importantly for the community and the producers in that area. It's always a bit of a judgment call when you have a situation like this. You look at what happened in the past and try to do everything that you can to make sure that it doesn't happen in the future. At the same time, it's important for if the producers who weren't paid before would ever get paid, that there be an operating facility so that some of that cash can perhaps be repaid. But also for the community of Northwood, it's important for them that they have an operating facility in the community as well. And although it's not incorporated into the record, the commission certainly received lots of public input from that particular area, both producers and from community leaders themselves, who, including state legislators from the area and others, who were very supportive of the commission acting on this quicker than the hearing date and looking if there were alternative ways for the commission to perhaps get this business opening, but in a way that prudently protects the interests of producers as well. I think this order strikes that right balance of protecting the producers, protecting the community of Northwood, and yet allowing a facility to go into business that perhaps can hopefully turn a profit into the future.
Well, I agree, and I think Tony's done an excellent job of describing the circumstances that bring us to this somewhat unusual conclusion. I think there are other factors to be considered as well. I think we have to remember that Northwood is a community that was devastated by a tornado not so terribly long ago, and that having a facility like this up and running, providing not only a market for what is proving this year to be a much larger canola crop than in previous years. We're expected to be about 85% more canola this year than last year, but also provide some jobs in the community as well. And then, of course, that means another customer for the petroleum and other retail industries in the community. So there's that. I would also add that I did early on contact the Department of Commerce, asked them to do some due diligence in addition to the work that Mike did in reviewing the business plan. And they did some due diligence specifically on the Russian investors who are investing $3 million, at least in the first phases, $3 million, and in return for a 26% ownership in the company. That presents both challenges and opportunities, obviously. On the one hand, it is, you know, sometimes a bit uncomfortable to consider that we will be, you know, selling more of North Dakota or the United States to Russian investors. On the other hand, it perhaps opens up some markets that we wouldn't otherwise have access to, and that's the global economy that we live in. So we did have some background work done on them, and we received no red flags, no concerns. I even went so far as to even call people I know that do a lot of work in Russia who said that it's a very serious company and a reputable company. So, you know, we did, like Tony said, we did more due diligence on this company and its new investors than most bonding companies do before they write an insurance policy for them, because usually they just say, sure, I'll give you a $100,000 bond. First, give me $100,000. You know, that's the level of their due diligence often. So I do think it strikes the right balance, and I'm glad we have this motion before us today, and I plan to support it.
Just, I guess, my 2 cents worth. I was, I think, pushing hard for a hearing, because I wanted the opportunity to hear from the folks that in the Northwood, whether it be the legislators, the community. And it's funny that we weren't getting the information. And all of a sudden we scheduled a hearing, and the information just flowed freely. And so that's what we really were looking for, is get the information so we could understand the viewpoint from all different sides, the community and the producers. But once the information was able to come in, once we tied up the part about the company, once we got the commerce in there, I think this is actually going to be a very good model to follow in the future, as we get into maybe perhaps more controversial companies setting up. So I'm glad this worked out, and I also will be supporting it.
It's a good, very good point that Brian makes. In fact, I suspect that because we scheduled the hearing, you're right, we did get more action both on our part and probably on the community's part, and we probably got more information than we would get at a hearing, because a hearing can be very inconvenient for people, but sending a letter can be done on their own time. And so I think that's an important point. I think the other thing, though, I think the distinction that we need to make is that, and Tony made it right up front, and we probably need to remind everybody that without a hearing, this none of this information is evidence or testimony. What it is, though, is it's public input. We've never taken in evidence and testimony for a license application or issuing a license anyway, so it's not like there's anything new. But it is nonetheless, it was valuable to hear from the community. So, good point.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Very good. Commissioner Kolk.
Good morning. I have one item today, item BK1.
It's an important one.
I move the Commission adopt the order approving Otter Tail Power Company's 2010 Renewable Resource Cost Recovery Adjustment Factor, case number PU1018.
Second.
I'll try to hit the highlights, I guess, of this case. On December 31st of 2009, Otter Tail Power filed its application for approval of its 2010 Renewable Resource Cost Recovery Adjustment Factor. In 2008 and 2009, the Commission approved similar type riders for the wind farms in Langdon and in Ashtabula. So basically, in 2010, this rider provides for addition of the Laverne Wind Farm and an update to the cost recovery calculation. We scheduled a hearing. We had interveners. In this case, the large industrial group comprised of Goodrich Corporation, Cargill, Cavendish Farms, Archer Daniel Midland Company, Comdale Innovation, Tharaldson Ethanol, Bobcat Company, and Primewood formed a large industrial group, and they asked for intervention, and we granted them intervention. Case worked its way through the traditional PSC routing. And on July 30th this year, the Commission received a letter stating that the large industrial group agrees with the findings of our advocacy staff that the this agreement sufficiently documents that the recalculated renewable resource rider is appropriate and it's met all the parameters that we need. So with that, the order states that Otter Tail Power investment in Luverne Wind Farm is useful and used in service for the convenience of the people of the public of North Dakota. The costs associated with the Luverne Wind Farm project should be included in the Otter Tail Power's renewable resource cost recovery adjustment factor. And what that really means, I guess, in impact to the consumer, the previous rate for the two wind farms was roughly, for the average customer, $2.70, 0.00369 per kilowatt. The updated rate, including the Luverne Wind Farm and the recalculated numbers, goes to 0.00551, or an increase of $1.37 for the additional wind farm, bringing the total amount for the average customer of $4.13. And the way this will lay out is that this will stay in place. It'll go effect September 1st of this year, and we expect that December 31st of 2011, the company will come back and do an updated filing, and then we'll see where the numbers look like then. Eventually, this will probably get rolled into base rates, but now given the availability of production tax credits and other things, having this rider broken out this way I think is the best way to capture the costs and make sure we're doing the right thing for the consumers.
One thing that isn't always captured in this, and I don't know if there's any way to capture it other than just explain to folks, is that while the rider appears on folks' bills, what doesn't appear on people's bills is the decrease in their rates that happens elsewhere. And what I mean by that is that by having these wind investments, wind oftentimes is a resource that takes offline other resources that the company would otherwise need to buy. So on a day that's fairly hot and fairly windy, or fairly cold and fairly windy, when there are high power needs, there's a lot of power that comes off those wind farms. That's power that, if not for the wind farm, Otter Tail would probably need to go out onto the open market and buy, oftentimes buying at a premium price because it's on the days when every other utility is also seeing their system peak. And so what consumers don't see is the money on the other side that they're not getting charged because Otter Tail has incorporated this into their own, has incorporated the specific line item. And I don't know that there's a great way to correct for that. I think the unfortunate thing is it makes wind perhaps look a little boutique, or that we're treating it a little different or something like that. And it's certainly not intended to be that way, but this is how effectively and practically you're able to incorporate these appropriately into Otter Tail's base expenses. But it's an issue that people need to understand. While you'll see this line on your bill, you're also not seeing perhaps significant costs at certain times that Otter Tail's not needing to procure because you have this wind power.
They actually testified that the fuel cost adjustment, in the fuel cost adjustment, there would be a credit of about 0.8 cents per kilowatt hour, which is the offset to the other side. So that there isn't a specific line item in the bill that shows that you're getting nearly a penny off on the fuel cost side, but it does show this rider. In general terms, I like the riders for wind farms. The depreciation curve is very steep. The cost curve declines very quickly in the early years, and so allowing the customer to ride that cost down that steep curve rather than locking them in at a rate base that is very high is much more fair to the rate payer. So as a general principle, I like this type of a recovery method, although I still want to hear every single one. I'm not advocating that become the policy of the commission, but in generally speaking, I like the riders.
Yeah, that's a good point, because what happens is, I mean, take a company like Otter Tail where they went 24 years between rate cases. Now, if you lock in a really quickly depreciating asset during a rate case and then don't have one for 20 years, but the asset's been depreciated for 15, you've got customers potentially overpaying. So it's a little bit unique to wind. It's probably an appropriate way to deal with it, but there are just some quirks with it.
And the more the companies and the interveners and the commission get used to these things, the easier they become every year.
Yeah.
I would say this one was a lot easier than last year's, and I'm sure from the very first one.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All in favor?
Aye.
That concludes the items in my portfolio.
And that concludes our agenda, at least of official votes. There are a few announcements, and it's really a substantive day at the commission besides, you know, some of the media issues that we've voted on. We have three work sessions this afternoon, really two work sessions. One is on We have a work session on the Otter Tail and Northern States Power Advanced Determination of Prudence for the CapEx 2020 investment that is interesting. First of all, it's been some time since we've had the hearing on this. We had an informal hearing We had a formal hearing on a settlement agreement between the advocates in the case and the companies in the case. Of course, CapEx 2020 is a very large transmission build-out, largely in Minnesota, some in North Dakota, which opens up some export capacity for North Dakota energy, but more importantly, provides a lot of reliability to the system of several utilities. Advanced determination of prudence we've all become very familiar with, both the upside and the downside, although we don't hear much complaining about the several ADPs that we've done for wind farms that have turned out very well. We've heard a lot of criticism about the advanced determination of prudence in one other very high-profile case. So here we come this afternoon to talk about, in a work session, this ADP before us relating to CapEx 2020. So it should be an interesting work session. With that, let's see what other announcements are there. Many of our staff, especially in the Public Utilities Division or the old Public Utilities Division, as well as some of the transmission companies and some South Dakota utility regulators will be in Bismarck this afternoon, today, beginning with tomorrow and Friday. They're coming in tonight, a lot of them, for a workshop that we are hosting on transmission, and we look forward to that. That's at Bismarck State College at the Student Union Prairie Room tomorrow and Friday. Anything else big before our next meeting? I don't think so, although our admin agenda is also pretty full today. We're going to discuss EPA proposed rules relating to the disposal of coal combustion waste. Jim's going to lead us in a discussion on that because I intend to probably testify at one of the EPA hearings on the topic. We're going to talk about the Frayne Barracks Crossing because some interesting things have happened, evidently, in the community since we issued that order. And as you might remember, we did receive a letter from Plains Justice regarding the Keystone Pipeline and some possibility of faulty pipes. So we'll be discussing our response to them as well. With that, any other announcements, commissioners? We'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
With the CapEx 2020 Advanced Determination of Prudence, I mean, there's a lot of opposition to that project, too. Are you running the same risk that you ran with Big Stone, that you might be determining the prudency of a project that's not going to get built?
It's something we're fully aware of, and
it
was
the
subject of a lot of questions at the settlement conference. We'll talk about this some more this afternoon, but we had there was a significant amount of testimony and a significant amount of questioning from commissioners about how we can ensure that if we do issue an advanced determination of prudence on the CapEx 2020 line, is there a way to mitigate the risk and ensure that financially ratepayers aren't left on the hook because of something that goes on in another state that potentially scuttles a project that would otherwise be needed and perhaps good.
I want to make sure that I heard the numbers correctly on the renewable adjustment factor. I have 0.00369 cents per kilowatt hour.
That's
the existing rate.
Right.
And 0.00551 per kilowatt hour, the proposed new rate.
Correct.
And when does that new rate go into effect?
September 1st of this year.
Okay. It was my experience that when this thing was first enacted, there was an initial rate that was approved, and then it changed before the following year's rate was enacted. How does that work?
Yeah, good question.
Well, the whole – I might have to have Mike jump in here, but that's part of this filing was to include the Laverne Wind Farm, plus go through all their calculations and to make sure what they'd been charged, what the rates going forward all made good sense. The large industrial group agreed. Our own advocacy staff agreed. Maybe, Mike, you want to jump in on that one?
Well, and it is an annual renewal. So they come before us once a year to recalculate based on the history of the year.
And what it actually produces to what they show. And
yeah, the first
year we did was kind of as good a guesstimate as we could make, and then it was revised, I think, downward from there the first time. And
right.
Yeah, because the reason I asked is that I think this is the third year this has been done, and
right.
I went back to the the first. It turns out that the first 2 years of data that I had in terms of what the adjustment was not the same as the commission initially approved. It wasn't the same rate, and I was wondering why that changed.
It had to do with the capacity factors that they were finding at the wind farms themselves,
okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
I don't want
based on energy output, and so the right. First it was a guess. And
I don't want to dwell on it, but yeah. The rate that we have presently, how many megawatts of wind power does that cover, do you know?
I'm going to have to get back to you on that, Dave.
But it covers the Langdon.
How many megawatts
Langdon and Ashtabula.
Langdon and Ashtabula 1 and 2?
Right, for the first two. Okay. And this one now incorporates the Laverne Wind Farm and updated cost.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. I'm sure we can dig up that number, but, all these wind farms, not all of them, but there are fractional ownerships of
right.
Some of these, and so it's can be tough to sort out.
Okay, on North Dakota oilseed mills, does the new ownership group have any obligations for the debts of the previous?
No, they do not. But the 74% owners the 74% owners, which are the same owners from Northwood Oil or Northwood Mills, do have an obligation, so that with the 74% of the profits that come into the company, they will be using those profits to pay off old debt.
Do they have a legal obligation or just a?
Well, they have they feel certainly a moral obligation. They have agreed, as a condition of this license, to do exactly that. Several of them are in the room. I might as well introduce them since you've brought them up. Paul Sproul, who's the president, Clarence Leschide, who maybe you've heard of from time to time in all of this. Jeff Bankston is with us. Jeff, let them know who you are. And then Alan Collette is one of the claimants and a producer in the Grafton area, and Bill Kingsbury, who's also a producer in the Grafton area. Alan and Bill are some small dirt farmers up there in the Northern Valley that do very well.
And Bison fans, I hear, too.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
What is there a condition of the licensing of the new company a? You mentioned yeah. is there any condition on the licensing of the new company that these old debts be repaid? I want to make sure I understood you correctly.
Yeah.
What's
I find the language for you?
No,
order itself. We
it
don't have the authority
in the order
to.
Itself. And the, I mean, any obligations that the elevator would have to pay former claimants is, of course, a civil court matter. And I don't know what the standing of all that would be if there is anything related to that. I mean,
just kind of
right?
Cut this down a bit.
Mm-hmm.
This licensing does not have any provision that the owners of the former company that incurred the debts that were not paid, they don't have to repay those debts as a condition of the license.
Yeah, we can't. We don't have the authority to order that.
Okay.
But we're encouraged by their willingness to do so.
And the public input that we received this last week overwhelmingly supported the people that were owed money from the previous elevator supported this new operation in their public comments.
That includes both producers and vendors.
So the creditors of the former company support this? Is that what you're saying?
It's the ones we heard from.
The ones we heard from.
Did you hear from all of them?
We did not hear from all 11 claimants, although I think two of the three producers we did hear from, one of them's in the room right now, we did hear from a lot of the local vendors.
Just a couple that didn't.
Yeah, some of the larger maybe. There are a couple of Canadian buyers that we hadn't heard from, or producers, not producers, but grain companies, and maybe a couple of Twin Cities ones.
But I just want to make it clear that it is not a condition of this
right.
action that the old debts be repaid. You don't have the authority to do that according to
that's correct.
What you said. And
but we do have authority to require the cash payment, of course, and then
raise the bond.
Level. Raise the bond to cover.
Agree they agreed to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, to the degree they agreed to it, right.
Okay. Is this Did you think about more than 100,000?
Yes.
How much did you think about?
Well, it's hard to know how much to think about, and that's the challenge we have. Remember that we've just been through an interim committee process where they've explored all of these issues in great length and came to the conclusion that it ought to remain exactly the same. So the way we came up with 100,000, I say we, like I came up with it, I didn't, but the way 100,000 came up was because, first of all, it's double what the law would normally require, which is a very good faith effort, I think, on the part of the investors. And secondly, it will cover a day's worth of a big day's worth of business, which means that the cash-only way of buying product should be covered if there should be a problem with the check at the bank.
Right. Yeah, to what extent is the cash, requiring them to operate as a cash business, to what extent is this going to inhibit their flexibility?
Well, it's a very good point, Dale. I suspect that to some degree it might, but they're in the business. They could answer that a lot better than we could. And Tony talked about striking the balance. And if there's, obviously striking a balance means that there's a little give on each side, and that might be one factor that could be somewhat.
This had to be something that we could support, and if it didn't have that language in there, I don't know that I would have supported it. Mm-hmm. Now they can come back next year, and if things go well this year, which we hope they do, we change the way it reads next year. Maybe it reads differently.
So I have a load of canola, and even if I'm willing to extend credit, not extend it to me. Is that right?
That's right, and that is a great point. Obviously, I suppose you could extend credit by stuffing the check in your top drawer. There's some tradition of doing that too. But at some point, it's not my problem anymore, and that's the balance I always have a hard time finding.
But I just wanted to make sure, even if there is a situation where the supplier of the canola is willing to not take immediate payment, the company is obliged to provide
immediate payment. And the idea is to bring in time a closer period between when that producer is paid, when they actually turn over the product, and what that will hopefully do is will mitigate potential volatility down the line. Remember, with the original company, what apparently happened was canola was purchased at a certain price when the price was very high. They believed they had a buyer for the product. The buyer backed out, but by then producers had already been promised a certain price. In the intervening time, the market collapsed, and that's how companies get themselves in trouble in high volatility situations. And so by closing that time period, we're hoping to mitigate some of that. And after, a year's track record, we might feel like we have some more comfort in allowing more flexibility.
On Ashtabula 3, do you know when construction is going to start? Do you have any idea?
I wouldn't be surprised if it starts this week.
This
afternoon, there'll be trucks rolling. They wanted to start quickly.
Okay. And as far as the Williams County Road 9 project, do you know if the BNC concrete paving, you mentioned, I think it was $99 per cubic foot.
Yes.
Was that cubic the low yard. Bid?
Cubic yard, wasn't
excuse
it?
Me, cubic, yeah. Excuse me, cubic yard. Yeah. Was that the low bid?
It was, yeah.
And they're just willing to supply more grout
at the same
bid, price.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And had we had any idea that it was going to be 2,000, we would have had them bid it at that. But this is a pretty unusual circumstance.
I guess I'm a little, do you think that the bidding situation would have been different if there had been a situation where, okay, we're going to bid 2,000 cubic yards?
It's the part that gives me a little uneasiness, frankly, Dale, because, of course, volume allows you to bid things lower. And so had we known it was 2,000 cubic yards instead of 1,000 cubic yards, would other bidders have maybe been able to do it at $99. I don't know whether they would have or they wouldn't have, but we based it on what we knew at the time and the circumstances have changed, and this is clearly the most prudent way to handle it.
Well, at this point, we're into August, and it could be snowing in a month. We need to get these things taken care
of. Boy, that's...
Let's hope not.
Jeez, it comes with the bison fan thing, and then it's snowing. He's just rebellious today.
Full of optimism, aren't you? Yeah.
Rebecca and Amanda are going, O'Brien. Get me back to Florida.
the Enbridge pipeline situation, yes. If I understood you correctly, you frankly have the option of saying that this, of overruling the local zoning.
We don't have that option unless there's a finding that would...
If you made the finding.
If we made the finding. That's right. There'd have to be a showing.
It's pretty high standard.
It's a high standard. It would have to be proven to us that it was, that it just was unreasonable. That's what it'd have to be.
It's a rare occurrence. I mean,
do you think that you wouldn't able to be make to? Do you think that you wouldn't be able to make that finding?
It would depend on the facts in each circumstance. We did once with a transmission line, and it's the only time that I can remember doing it in 10 years, and probably going back, it's the only time that's been done in quite some time. But it requires a specific set of facts where you can actually prove that there's some sort of harm that's done, and that it's an unreasonable harm, or that the local board is acting in an unreasonable or capricious manner, or something like that. So it's a fairly high standard to have to meet to overrule a local zoning board.
Did you consider that option to do the sort of exploration you might need?
Well, we would have had to preemptively do it, because remember they haven't acted yet, so we wouldn't. I mean, realistically, we're not going to preemptively.
They meaning the Berthold City Council.
That's right.
Now, or Ward County, or
right, or a township. But the reality is this is under the jurisdiction of the city of Berthold from a local zoning and planning perspective. The mayor, there was a lot of local official involvement at the hearing itself. It was all very cordial. It was all very supportive, quite honestly. While there were certain concerns, it was not in any way confrontational or combative. And everybody was committed to working with each other to make it all work out. And they may very well yet. Brian Biella is in the room today, and he is counsel for Enbridge. And I think, is it Monday that the City Commission votes, Brian? Yeah. So the Berthold City Commission will be voting on this recommendation from the Zoning Board next Monday. It will obviously be an interesting meeting. But, it has to be unreasonably restrictive. And that can be include economically unreasonably restrictive. It can include, all kinds of other factors. But it's a pretty high standard. And while this is a transmission line, it is, in many respects, it has the footprint of a facility. So it falls under the transmission law, but it's...
If the land is not rezoned for industrial use, is the project stopped?
Well, Dale, if I could, the gist of the discussion they had was we had an application for a certain site to build something, and all the background environmental was all done in that. So that's the decision we'll make based on what they submitted. The folks in the community there wanted that somewhere else. So they thought we could basically just take this plant and move it somewhere else. It doesn't work.
They wanted the pumping station somewhere else.
Right. They did. They wanted it west of there, and that's what their point was. But our charter says we look at the application, we look at that footprint, and make a determination accordingly. We don't have the ability to move it. If for some reason this doesn't get approved, they might come back with another project to put it in a different location. Then we would go on that one.
So they wanted to move the existing... The local preference was to move the existing
pumping. Well, there was some testimony to the fact that they could put it recommending putting it on the west side of this railroad track. The existing station is directly next to or adjacent to the railroad track and is on the east side. So to put the expansion on the west side would be to have their complete facility separated by a railroad track, which would require, of course, pipes underneath the tracks, which may not be a big deal, but you also then create two facilities, not one. And so then the next question becomes, so then do you move the entire facility to the other side of the track? So that's some of the information that was in. But for the most part, the community wanted to mitigate as much of the traffic risk as possible. In my mind, that traffic risk has been mitigated, especially to the satisfaction of the professionals, which is the Department of Transportation. That satisfies me. But if it doesn't satisfy the local community and they don't zone it appropriately, to meet this order, then we'll either have another hearing or it'll be up to Enbridge to make the next move.
Is the land rezoning necessary for the upgrade to take place?
Yes.
It is.
Okay. Additional 80 acres, I think, is the challenge.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, there are 8 truck stations in there, a lot of piping, another tank, as I recall, and upgrading of an existing tank, which probably wouldn't require it. But
could you refresh my memory? What was the transmission capacity of the 10-inch Bridger line, and what's the...
It's a 12-inch line now. It was started out as a 10-inch. It has become a 12-inch line. It has 60,000 barrel per day capacity.
What was it before?
When it was 10?
When it was 10. I was wondering what it was. I don't know what it was because it didn't say in the letter of intent. And I don't, Pat, do you remember what the capacity was?
I bet Pat could figure that out.
Probably. Yeah. It would be about 25% less, I suppose, 20% less.
I was just wondering if it was that simple.
I don't know if it is. It probably isn't. Depending on the pressure. Here's the engineer. It depends on the pressure. How many pumps are we going to put on this thing?
Your volume increases, right? If there's a circle more pattern, you can tell me that.
You know, it's another whole, we'll talk about it this afternoon, but the whole TransCanada thing, the funny part is that the thinner the pipe, the more pressure, the higher the pressure on the pipe, which is another topic for this afternoon's work session.
When are you talking about
feedback? Soon.
After we sign orders.
Soon as.
You know, all the big things that we've done here today, Rebecca, and you want to talk about train whistles. That's why there's a TV camera in the room, too.
Millions of dollars.
What does that tell you? What does that tell you?
Power lines, pipelines, wind farms.
If something was waking you up in the middle of the night, you'd think it's pretty important.
Trains are
too.
Sexy and pipelines aren't, I guess. Okay. All right. It's video. Yeah, you can shoot a train. You can listen to the whistle. Yeah, you could probably go get some stock footage. You don't even have to. There you go. Now we're talking her language. Okay. If there's no other silliness, we'll take a recess for about 10 minutes, sign orders, and come back for the administrative portion and talk about frame barracks.